This is Professor Gundlach's ethics class on November 5th, 2008 in Roosevelt 109.
Because Going to be offer, so don't sweat. So the perspective on the outside of the skin, you might mind about perspective too. So there was a bar study that was done, a bar topic study that was done a few years ago for the law school. And it basically gave us a whole kind of metric study of the statistics that show a certain correlation for success with passing the bar or failure with passing the bar. Based on a certain, and again, it's kind of an array of factors. So what we have done is we have followed that statistical model and automatically enrolled a certain community of students into the class. For those of you who are not automatically enrolled into the class, there's still the opportunity to take the class. And we automatically enroll just because we want to be able to give those students the opportunity to take it if they so desire for the spring semester. There will be additional seats available going forward next year. The Keeper graduate, you don't care, but you know, we had a deal that was in place with the Keepers to offer this course, and there wasn't really any adjustment I could do other than these two sections. That is true, because we don't have the room capacity. There will be these limitations. I forget what many of you can fit in each section, but again, we've automatically enrolled some students. Alright, well, we'll see what happens, and you know, again, it is what it is. But this is what they did last year and the year before. Any other questions? So moving into the material for today, I just want to do a quick recap about what we covered last week. We spent a lot of time on Carl's story. And I just want to remind you of the structure of the analysis of how we worked through that problem on page 335. There were two parts of Rule 3.3 that we looked at. We looked at the A3 and paragraph B. So the A3 has the attorney submitted false evidence that the lawyer knows to be false and that is material to the proceedings. The other one in paragraph B is, does the attorney know that the client engaged in similar fraudulent conduct? So they're two separate questions. One deals with false evidence, one deals with criminal and fraudulent conduct. And really, we went through those questions of, does the attorney know about it? Is it material? Is it actually fraud? Is it a crime? Is it false evidence? Etc. And then we also talked about what you need to work through as far as if you do conclude that the attorney knows about it, but it's false or criminal or fraudulent, then you need to correct the fraud or false evidence, even if that means disclosing confidential information. We also talked about how you would want to talk to the client, encourage the client not to proceed with this, and ultimately you may have to ask for a withdrawal and or disclose to a certain extent in order to alleviate the situation. So, that would be the analysis that you would walk through under 3.3. Again, recognizing that because of the way the rule requires you to look into substantive law of fraud or any kind of criminal statutes that might be in play, you're going to ultimately have to do that research as well before you can make a determination about how to proceed under this rule. And today we'll be talking more about, again, this need to, when the ethics rules make some reference to criminal or fraudulent statutes, you're going to have to engage in that doctrinal research as well. And then we also spent a lot of time on this issue of whether or not we know that somebody is engaged. we actually do know what's happening. We also talked about witness coaching, and we did the lecture problem under rule, and again, looked at rule 3.383 as well as 3.4b. And we talked about the law of perjury, and you know, this is again a substantive area that you're going to need to be aware of in relationship to the ethics rules. And then we kind of ended up with the boundaries of proper argument and the master exercise and the eyewitness 1 and 2 problems. Were there any lingering questions about the material from last week? So, this week we get into this realm of what's called real evidence. And not as opposed to fake evidence, but real evidence in the sense that it's tangible in some capacity. So when we discussed the attorney-client privilege several classes ago near the beginning of the semester, one thing, if you recall, that we talked about, and those of you who've taken evidence know this as well, is that the privilege doesn't protect the underlying information, the underlying facts or the evidence. It only protects the communications between the attorney and the client. Okay? So I'll say that again. The underlying tangible evidence or facts are not protected. It's only the communications themselves. Remember when we talked about Upjohn, et cetera, and how the communications were not going to be, were going to be protected, but the actual facts relating to whatever the conduct was would not be. So this week's material illustrates this point, and we learn about it in the Ryder decision, which we'll talk about in a minute. So the problem is, as I said before, is that many attorneys don't understand this distinction. If you walk out of my class understanding this distinction, you are so much more brilliant than many of the lawyers out there in practice, okay? And inevitably you'll pass the bar and you'll be great. So the issue is, with respect to the ethics component of this, is what's the lawyer's responsibility when the lawyer has learned about or comes into possession of this tangible or real evidence? And especially when it's relevant to some kind of pending proceeding or a proceeding that could very well come, you know, that one could be anticipated. So what's the lawyer's ethical obligation when the lawyer comes to know about this tangible evidence or actually comes into possession of it? Yeah. So we're going to get into that. So that's basically the gist of it, is that the notion is that the communication itself is what is going to be protected, assuming all of the protection and the elements are in place for application of the attorney-client privilege, but that the underlying tangible evidence doesn't somehow get swept up into that protection of the privilege. Exactly right. So, yeah.
So there was a secondary question.
By the way, this is always tested on the MCRA.
Yeah.
So hold that up. Okay. So here's how we're going to organize the material today and how we're going to spend our time in class. First, we're going to review Ryder. And that is really the ultimate case, every lawyer knows about it, that kind of sets up this issue of the attorney's ethical obligations relating to real evidence. Okay? Then we're going to review Meredith so we understand the evidentiary impact of real evidence and when it is or is not going to be protected by the privilege. And then we're going to look at the wording of some of the criminal statutes so that we can understand the limits that are going to be imposed with respect to criminal law, because the ethics rules inevitably reference these criminal, the criminal code, so that we understand when an attorney's possession of tangible evidence might violate a criminal statute. Okay?
And then we're going to run through some hypothetical situations, including the client who brings the gun to the lawyer and lays it on the desk, to see how all of this plays out. Okay, so let's start with Ryder, which was this federal case from Virginia State, Michael. Remind us about what happened in Ryder.
Ryder was the attorney representing a man who was robbing a bank with a sawed-off shotgun. And the FBI knew that certain money that was taken from the bank was fake money, so they had to list the serial numbers that were counterfeit.
Right.
Correct. And the defendant was found with some of this money.
Let me slow you down even from there. How did we get to that point? Because there's a lot of facts that happened from the moment that finding the money took the money to them getting to finding the money to save the money. Getting more tenuous as far as the evidentiary fact investigation goes. But on the other hand, he also acknowledges that another concern was with the FBI again. We knew the FBI would eventually want to take the testimony. Okay, so what did we do? So we, and what did the lawyer recommend to this guy who was so brilliant that he had to?
Do you see any reference to any kind of a
little bit of conflict of law analysis. So it's very interesting. They don't actually make any reference.
Sawed-off shotgun,
choice of the crime and also the crime weapon, the instrumentality of the crime. What about if we go back to this question that we talked about last week? Could Ryder have argued that he didn't know that this money was stolen or that this sawed-off shotgun was used in the robbery?
Well, I think he had a number of times the shotgun that used the money. First, he knows a sawed-off shotgun was used in the robbery. Second, like the first one, it's illegal for his client to use the death sawed-off shotgun.
Without any right.
At first, he's going to take it out of box, and then you give that whether or not the money and the gun are both evidence for it. Then he realized it's almost that, oh, I have a third level, they might not find it at all.
Right.
And at that point, I think if you say, well, you no longer have any excuse.
Right.
But at first, it seemed like he wasn't so much trying to conceal as he was. Well, if they get the money and the gun, I don't think they're going to work hard.
Right. It's all kind of peculiar, isn't it? I mean, yeah. You know, it's hard to get a sense of what his true motive was or whether there were mixed motives involved in this or what he was really trying to accomplish with all this. But it's really not really and the point being that, as you're saying, what you're basically saying is he was obstructing injustice because he has a federal statute and he was, you know, this federal proceeding. So he could very well be viewed as obstructing justice under 1990. So could Ryder have lawfully, let me ask a different question, have lawfully left the items in the box, then having known about them? Maybe he went and looked at them, saw them, and said, whoopsie-daisy, not sure I want to follow through with this scheme. I see that there's a sawed-off shotgun in there. I see that there's money in there. I'm just going to walk away.
Thank you.
I think it's problematic because, among other reasons, the slaughter of shotgun is illegal in itself. It's not as if his client owned license to carry a slaughter of shotgun. And I'm just keeping it away from him temporarily because I didn't want to kill someone, which that's what we're doing, to take away some of your client's gun if you think it's substantial like a father's on.
But we have this difficult situation, right? If we go back to the obstruction of justice situation, where this is the instrumentality of the crime. Let's say we know that it's the instrumentality of the crime. So you know it's the instrumentality of the crime. You're fearing that your client is going to use this gun in some capacity on somebody else. So you remove it. Are you done with your ethical obligations?
Yes. Some kind of intent, know that he was going, or you'll be assuming that he's dead.
Yeah, let's say we know, let's say we have a pretty good belief that he's going to be dead. Yeah, I'll say reasonable to tell you about that.
But if we use the test run, that you are trusting us, where it says, what if the police have been there, there's no
reason. So what do you do?
You have to turn over the police if you want to do that.
So what do you do? Just kind of saunter into the police station and say,
no, it's the same thing.
See you later.
It's the same thing in narrative. You turn over the wallet and turn it. It's the same thing.
Okay, and what if they say, whoa, whoa, we're calling you in as a witness to tell us where you got this sawed-off shotgun? So, and if phrase, because otherwise if we didn't have that phrase in, then we'd be out there disclosing every crime and fraud that our clients have engaged in, right? And then there would basically be no need for any kind of criminal case. Right? So great question. Thank you, Grace. Okay. So, let's see. So the bottom line, obviously, is it's unethical to purposely take control of an instrument or fruit of the crime in order to prevent the prosecutor or the authorities from getting it, assuming that the possession is unlawful. All right, so let's move to Meredith. How about Stephanie? Stephanie, walk us through Meredith.
Picks up the wallet and brings it back to Shank. Okay? So,
Frick has done something other than what he was instructed to do. Could Schenck have said, this is an ethics proceeding, hey, it's not my fault, Frick went off on a bender and did this on his own? Are going to be responsible for supervising our investigators, our paralegals, our associates, whomever reports to us. We need to make sure that they're doing the ethically correct thing as well. Okay, so we get to this issue now before the California court, and what ultimately does the court decide?
The court decides that
right, so it was the removal. It's once you touch it, remove it, alter it in any way, that's where all of a sudden we're outside of the realm of the privilege protecting the communications of the location of those tangible evidence. And you are now altering it in some way, affecting it in some way, which is going to be fair game for them to find out, to go back to the point of where you originally, how you originally found the tangible evidence. So, again, this is another big, famous case. Every lawyer out there knows this case, at least the facts. And I'm sure there's been 10 Law & Order episodes that stem from this decision. And then every other legal show is definitely a great case. So, what does the court say about the tactical choice that the lawyer faces when you know the tangible evidence is out there? Right, so you can choose to leave it and do what? Go look at it, see that it's there, you know, go like this, you know where it is, take your pictures, whatever, and walk away. And is that going to be protected? Do you have to disclose that in any way? No. Right. And if you touch it, then what? If you touch it, move it, alter it in any way. Right. Okay, so note two, I just want to point out in footnote 7 that the court states that Schenck didn't violate any ethics rules by taking the wallet to examine it because he later turned it over to the police. So that's another clear read for you that, according to Meredith at least, you can pick up the you can pick up the tangible evidence, you can examine it, and you can test it, as long as you don't alter it in any fundamental way, and then return it back to the proper authorities. But again, then once you've moved it or done anything to it, you're going to have to explain where you found it, how you found it in its original state that you came from. Okay. So the only other thing I was going to say is, I think this is noted in the notes after Meredith, that if a client, one of the gray areas still that's out there is if a client gives the attorney an item of evidence that forms a link in the chain of evidence, but it isn't itself an instrumentality of the crime, it isn't a product of the crime, through the crime in any way, it's just a link in the chain of evidence. But it's not itself a stolen piece of property or weapon or anything like that. The attorney-client privilege isn't going to protect it in the face of a subpoena. You see that the matter of the grand jury subpoenas from the Second Circuit and its many two cases in your book. But absent a subpoena, it's really unclear whether there's any ethical duty that the lawyer has, because technically it doesn't appear to fall into the realm of unlawful to possess it or do anything with it. So if it's not unlawful, it would seem that ethically speaking, it's okay. And yet it's still a link in the chain of evidence of a crime. So it's unclear whether or not the obstruction of justice statutes are going to reach that far to that kind of activity. And it's still really a gray area out there in the law. So I just kind of flag it for you. Okay, so you saw a couple of hypotheticals on pages 402, 403, 404. I just want to kind of run through them. All right, so Michael Rowan, let's go through the first one, and we'll, this is for the unfairly benefit of review. So let's say that I come to you, and I tell you that I shot someone. I'm sitting in your office, and you're listening, you're taking your notes, and all of a sudden you look up, and I go, and I put the gun, or a gun, I'll say, on your desk. What do you do? And how do you walk your way through this problem? How do you handle it?
Just put it on your desk.
Didn't touch it. I'll just let it sit there.
I'm going to probably take it because I think my boy thinks that if I took it, I'm probably just going to.
Well, so let's, okay, so you're raising a couple different questions. So let's stay on the same track that you started with. So you said to yourself, what's the first question you're going to ask yourself right at the box? You're sitting there and you're thinking to yourself, oh God, I can't get back to that mock up this box. What exactly did I do here? What do you mean? Okay, yeah. Okay, so you might want to ask yourself, okay, what's the communication here that's happened? So let's safely assume that the communication about the fact that the client shot somebody is going to be protected during the time being. Okay. But we have this tangible piece of evidence. Is that going to be protected by the privilege? The tangible piece of evidence? No. Exactly. So how you got to having this is going to be protected, but the fact that you have it is protected. Okay. What about this? Yeah. Yes. If the attorney is ultimately put on the stand, that's accurate. Right. Okay. So let's go back to the situation. Okay, so now we've kind of decided, okay, I know that this gun itself is not necessarily protected. It's not going to be protected by any kind of privilege or confidentiality. What's the ethically appropriate way to analyze? What's the ethical analysis? What do you have to ask yourself first? Before you even hand it over. Okay, let's assume it's material to the case. Yeah.
Did you do it? How did you get it?
Okay, so let's assume that we know it's the gun that was used to shoot somebody. Let's go through. So yes, you're exactly right. So you want to start with your fact investigation to clarify that you're in a situation where this is in fact the gun that was used to shoot somebody, that your client used to shoot. So now what do you have to ask yourself according to the ethics rules? What do the ethics rules say? What rule are we talking about? Michael, what rule are we talking about? You referenced it. Right, what does 3.4a say?
Okay.
So the key phrase that you need to remember is unlawfully. So what do you have to ask yourself to determine whether or not it would be unlawful for you to do anything with this gun? Right, and particularly what criminal statute? Yeah. Right, so you might want to look at accessory after the fact and what that constitutes. What you're really asking yourself is, if I take this gun, possess this gun, do anything with this gun, is that going to be unlawful? So I've got to look at all of the criminal statutes that would be potentially applicable here, criminal and federal. And hopefully you're a criminal lawyer, so you at least have, you know, the statute comes to you, so hopefully at least you've got some sense of where to begin to look in that regard. So that's the first thing that you're going to have to think about. Not the easiest thing when the client's sitting there on the other side of your desk and the gun is sitting there on your desk. But that's ideally how you want to approach this. Certainly from the employee's perspective, that's how you're going to want to approach it. Not probably realistic that you're going to be able to engage with this office for no desk reasons right there and there, but that's how we want to do it. So we'll go through and determine whether or not possession. So this is the instrumentality of the crime. Is possession of it going to be illegal if the attorney keeps it? What do you think, Michael? Right. What do you think the criminal statutes are going to say about you holding on to the gun that was used to kill somebody? Probably not such a good thing. So you can probably use your noggin at this point and kind of jump to, you want to do the confirmation of the research, but you can probably safely assume that holding on to the instrumentality of the crime actually is unlawful. Also, what else is unlawful? Let's say, even of itself, that's a big question mark in your mind. If you're holding on to a gun, by definition, it's unlawful. Why? Is it your gun? Do you have a license to hold that gun? No. So by definition, if you're holding that gun, you are engaging in the legal act. Okay? Probably. Again. Well, holding it for one foot.
That's a great question. I assume so.
By the little serial number, right? Right. You have to be associated with the serial number of the gun that you want.
You don't like security.
No, that's a great question.
For
Sarah Palin,
no, you actually have a license for state, and it's just typical based on your location in the state. So you could have a firearm with a license to carry it, which would just cover the state. You can have any type of gun. You have to then have an individual license for the gun, but it's separate from the general license.
So you have to base up two licenses. You have to be registered
when you
with
purchase
that gun.
A gun, it comes with a license itself. So it's a license to carry.
Okay,
but
yeah.
Then you actually have to have a separate.
Okay.
And then it's
really awesome. Just realized, let's take our 5-minute break. Sorry, then we're
going to
come back to this and finish up this analysis
before we move on. Yeah.
So what happened? Is that a huge
to register to vote in this election, and I think they assumed something that I wasn't saying.
What judge did you have on? Do you remember? The scary one.
Yeah.
Wait, the lady or like the yes, because he was scary. He scared my poor little client because he was asking her why she didn't vote in the last election and all this irrelevant information. Yeah, everyone else, the other judges, I had two or three other ones. They were all great, but him, I was just like. Yeah, and he wouldn't grant full orders like anything. You just got to, that's what I got. That was so great, yeah. That was a lot of fun.
Right. Right.
a tricky situation here because the ethics rules are a bit vague in this regard. I mean, you've got the criminal justice standards that you saw in the notes, which talk about how you actually can and should counsel your client about what the implications are, the legal implications are, of continuing to hold on to this gun. At the same point, I'm not sure that you want to counsel, you know, that walks the fine line of counseling your client to get rid of the gun or destroy it and destroy evidence.
But what if it's just, you know what, I suspect it's just my gun. So do I expect to take my option? Kind of like the movie.
Right, right. We're back to Beagler and how he approached this.
Yeah, so, you know.
You're probably right. You're pretty smart, and my guess is that you understand what the legal implications are of holding that gun. Yeah?
Can I do one thing?
Uh-huh.
Attorney
started to say have to, but then you corrected it yourself and said can. So just remember that 1.6 is a permissive disclosure, not a mandatory disclosure, except what we talked about last week if you're talking about a fraud on the court and the candor to the tribunal implications. Okay? Yep. 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 And then what?
You're not telling him in any way to get rid of it or do anything else with it. You're not telling him to go to somebody else. You're telling him you can't use it.
Right.
And
then
not know what it is.
Right. Right. And if you go by that strict criminal defense counsel, you know, mantra, if you don't want to know, then you're not even going to ask any questions. It's really interesting. I was watching a version of the practice this past weekend. When I was in a hotel, I happened to be flipping, and I came across an episode of The Practice, which was exactly the kind of a situation that was handled in the but yeah, I mean, I have friends who would say, they would even go so far that if a client that they represented said to them, I've got a bag of weed in my pocket, and the authorities don't know anything about it, that the lawyer would say, get rid of it. Here are the legal implications if you're found holding that bag of weed, get rid of it. Because there's no pending case that's out there, there's no arrest, this isn't contraband because they haven't been arrested yet, so there's no pending proceedings. I think other people would disagree with that. So I pose it as this area. There's a lot of grayness in this realm. Yeah.
It's not like the next case where they said that probably was better off to hold this for.
Right. That's exactly right. Right. Yeah. You saw that in the book. Right. Okay. So, yeah. The long and the short of it is there are some concrete things that you can take away with this. That, you know, if you don't touch it, don't move it, don't alter it in any way. As far as where it is, the location of it, you're not going to have to reveal anything about it. You're not going to have to reveal your communications with your client about the tangible evidence, etc. If you actually do that, then you are going to potentially have to be called up to testify that if you're asked to do so. It's not going to be protected by the privilege. But there's obviously a lot of gray areas in these types of let's look at Vanity Inc. So dramatic. Okay, yes. Thank you. research the implications of the attorney-client privilege, again, in the same situation, the prospective clients who share information with you.
So who's my client?
But you said you client the same thing.
Well, I don't want to.
Right, so after the implant. Okay, so... So you don't want to take it because the guy's guilty. So this is confidential privilege information. So, you know, they walk out of your office with the rope, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
Assuming that the judge is going to allow you to withdraw, right? Assuming you've already done your appearance. Okay. So going on to Vanity Inc. So Roland and Steven, let's kind of have you guys address this. So it's on page 401. Roland, what happened to this problem? It's on page 401. So who's the attorney? What's the attorney role here? Is the pen illegal to possess? What do we think? Okay, why not? Say that again. Say it louder. make me the best argument that on the other side does, that actually the possession itself is illegal. Uh-huh.
Maybe just because it's a dog feature that so that was used in the case that the dog was so it's obviously the probably the pen that was used, so
so it's the instrumentality of the crime. What's the crime? The tax fraud. Right. So why is this any different from a gun? Okay. Is instrumentality of the crime by definition something that's inherently dangerous to others?
No.
So, interesting argument. Okay. So, the idea in your mind is it doesn't rise to, it's not the same as a gun. It's inherently different than a gun. All of this pen happens to be a unique kind of pen, but it's just a pen. And in any other situation, this pen is going to be completely irrelevant evidence. Nobody cares about the pen. What's your reaction? And in fact, the pen is going to link the client to the tax fraud. Right. So there might be, I mean, again, just kind of to add.
Because of the nature of the object, the pen is possibly the same as the tax fraud. Before you even get to decide on whether it is not, don't you have to do something? If you can convince at least yourself that there's a possibility that this particular shade of ink went out to, let's say it was popular in the company, and the lawyer just from his personal knowledge does not know that. But if he called up the company and found out that, oh yeah, you know, this particular shade of purple was popular, then if he turned it in, he really unnecessarily went to his client.
Sure.
Where it's like, ooh, I have this one pen.
Alright, so Adam is, rightfully so, first question you need to ask yourself is, what else do I need to know here? And again, is there a fact investigation that I need to be able to put myself in a situation to better analyze the ethical dilemma that I'm faced with? Okay?
Thinking, can you imagine a situation where that might be a bad idea?
up in your role.
Just strategically speaking.
Strategically, to do nothing from the client's perspective might be to do nothing, meaning not even to talk to the client. The client might have other things like this. Say they're still at 3 weeks away from the trial. Mm-hmm. You don't know what can happen if they go to someone else.
But it's in your office. You've left it in your office.
Well, this particular thing is in my office. If I do nothing and not talk to that, if he's asked to lie about it, or if it's an end, you know, all the tens like it.
Right.
I mean, to do nothing, I think it's again, that leaves open an opportunity for something that you can't foresee.
Right. And God forbid that you have the other side walking into your office for some kind of a negotiation or something with pens laying on your desk or something like that. Right. I mean, what you have to remember is it's the corrupt intent. I mean, for purposes of the obstruction of justice charges anyway, you've got to have a corrupt intent. And, you know, obviously there's reams and reams of case law out there about what constitutes corrupt intent and whether there's sufficient evidence of that. And, you know, that's a big question mark of whether or not they'd be able to prove that if you just completely, you know, turn a blind eye. And you could say, I didn't even realize that this would be intent. I was just using it.
I was having trouble reading it. There was only like one sentence later in the chapter on this telephone bill case,
yeah,
which was sort of a link in the adventure. But because the nature of the document of the telephone.
Right, that's the grand jury case that
right,
I talked about earlier.
The court said that without a subpoena, they had had a duty to turn it over. In light of the subpoena, they didn't mention what would happen to the subpoena.
Right, short of a subpoena, what happens? Do you have an ethical obligation? Good question.
Right, it's different than a gun.
Right. So, and, you know, as Roland said, you could hear what bar counsel would say if an ethics case was ever pursued or a criminal case was ever pursued against a lawyer. It would go exactly like Roland would say. This is different from just any ordinary pen. You should have been on notice. This clearly put you on notice. And, you know, we can read a corrupt intent from the fact that you did nothing, didn't disclose it, didn't inquire about it, etc.
What we were saying before, when there's something
not material, right, so it's in the chain, the link in the chain, which is going back to the telephone bill, exactly. And I actually did have a situation like this that happened in practice where I had exactly that, where it was something that was brought to my attention by a client, a piece of tangible evidence that was a link, that would have been a link, but ultimately was not in itself a legal dispossessed or intrinsic crime or anything like that. And we've researched this to death. It's actually a funny case, and the students researched this issue to death. And it's a gray area. You know, it all depends on how close does it get to being relevant material evidence that you know is material and that you know is, you know, going to be problematic if you're withholding.
Is it also kind of clear whether it matters whether subpoena is issued or not? Or is it saying that you can't hold it in both ways?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Right. It's one of those unsatisfying areas. Exactly right. So, I mean, as far as what, you know, what can be done here, and certainly turn it over to the authorities without revealing where, you know, the lawyer got it, you know, it's one possibility. Another is, you know, certainly one, maybe do some fact investigation to figure out. It could strategically, going back to the strategic question, it could be strategically smart to actually do the fact investigation and talk to your client about it. You know, it very well may be that your client's position is somebody took this pen, or I took this pen from somebody else. And maybe the person that he borrowed it from was the one who actually engaged in the tax fraud. So you might actually be able to pin this on somebody else and have a legitimate defense. So there's lots of strategic reasons why you might want to do it separate from the ethics case. What about, Justin, I'm going to stay with you in a moment. If you look at that hypothetical on page 403 about the client who's charged with murder tells the attorney that he committed three other murders as well, that were not yet known by the DA, and then he shows the bodies to the lawyer. What do you think? Did the attorney move the bodies, do anything with the bodies? Did the attorney just look at the bodies and say, well, that's a bummer, and walk away? So it's a past crime, okay. So what about, so certainly seeing the bodies in and of itself, right, this is now confidential information that's been shared, it's a past crime. Assuming that there's no further danger that this is a repeat, you know, serial killer, maybe with three bodies you could argue it is. But presumably you're in a situation where there's no future crime disclosure possibility under 1.6. Can you do anything with the bodies? Yeah. Good point. Right. Right. Under Meredith, what does it say? If you do decide to move the bodies, what's going to happen?
Then you're
going to
have to hand
them
over.
Yeah. Again. Right. Right. So you could theoretically inspect them or do whatever you want to do with the dead body, and then you're going to have to inform the authorities and doctors. And again, if he actually removes them in any way, you're going to have to then deliver them to the authorities and talk about where in fact you found them. And your point being that you don't actually have to disclose to the VA if you do nothing, and that's absolutely right. If you look at the People v. Belch case, another very famous case, again, tons of Law and Order episodes on this, from 1975, it was a New York case, the court ruled that the privilege shielded counsel from disclosing or being charged with violating the health law, because what happened is the lawyer waited 10 months to disclose where these bodies were, and it was found to be a violation of the public health care, public health care for not disclosing these bodies. So what about, we'll go on to now problem reliable sources say. Adam, let's go to you on page 401. So remind us what's going on in this problem.
Okay. The main character attorney is the general counsel for Flash Pharma, which is a 500 drug company. And one of the four companies that account for 80% of the market in drugs. And he reads in the Wall Street Journal that according to reliable sources, the Justice Department has began an investigation into the price fixing involved his company. And although he has no reason to believe that the company engaged in price fixing, he wants to care. And he mentions that the company has pre-existing intentions to charge a policy about documents and emails every 120 days, unless it's specifically set aside to destroy certain old emails, or not necessarily old documents, but at least old emails, and specifically he wants to know how to protect both the company and himself against charges of obstruction of justice.
Right. So the long and the short of it is, he thinks the company might be under investigation, certainly doesn't have any confirmation of that. He's speculating based on a newspaper article that's pretty vague. And there's this normal destruction of document policy going on. And he's concerned about whether or not he has to somehow stop that, alter that policy in some way, because of his vague notion that his company might be under investigation and he's unbeknownst to him. So why should this concern any CEO now in this day and age, in light of what? What big case came or cases came out of this, that this is kind of beginning to sound like? Right, Arthur Andersen, Enron, right, WorldCom, all these, right. So the concern is this destruction piece. And if you remember, does anybody remember the series of emails of what happened? We're getting too far away from that event. Yes. Right, right. So exactly right. So there was this email, this massive email that was sent out that, you know, basically started destroying documents. Okay, so it's kind of also this reliable sources is kind of similar to that hypo on page 402. So what do you think? Can, again, does the general counsel Ethically, can he do nothing? And just permit with the regular document destruction procedures?
I thought, ethically speaking, there's no problem in just letting the procedure go. I thought that if his primary concern was acting ethically and avoiding obstruction of justice charges, then just letting the pre-existing policy that the company had continue without interference, I thought that he was on the same track.
So that's, again, strategically speaking, there might be reasons to go ahead and stop the procedures, because you might actually find some exculpatory evidence. I mean, there might be nothing going on, and it might be that you want to get a head start on any pending investigation, you know, any impending investigation or charges that are brought against the company. So you want to start engaging in your own investigations, which is often the case. And if you're, you know, you very well may remember the case we read earlier where, you know, there was an investigation they started underway within the company. That's a pretty typical reaction. Yeah, that's done. Right, so that's a good point, actually. I mean, I think probably the better thing to do is just stop all document destruction and engage in an investigation.
I thought, and I wrote that according to the obstruction of justice statute, you have to have terms corrupt
intent, right?
Basically, just doing something for an improper purpose. But just by involving himself in the obstruction policy, if you see something that, you know, may go against his company, you know, but it's not even certain, and he thinks, oh, it's not important enough. But he then allows him to be sure the normal course of his policy, well, then it becomes something more than being sure.
Right. Well, and what you have to, what's hard about this, if you're, you know, if you're strategizing over what to do about this, you really have to put yourself in the minds of the potential jurors who might someday charge you with obstruction of justice, and whether or not there's going to be evidence that, you know, jurors might find sufficient to find that corrupt intent. Yeah. Right. So what I was going to say, if you note on page 411, this, you know, definition of official proceeding doesn't necessarily have to be a pending proceeding. If you think that there's any possibility, you probably want to go ahead and stop that procedure. So it all depends. I mean, the way that he has found out about it is incredibly vague. It's through a newspaper article. There's no citation of the company's name. He's gotten no wind of it from the authorities in any way. You very well might be in an okay situation at this point. Again, strategically, you still might want to go ahead and do something. The other thing that you have to ask yourself is whether you want to pick up the phone and actually call the authorities and say, hey, can you give me any read on this, and whether or not this involves my company? The likely answer is going to be no comment, click. But you might be able to at least get a read that it's not your company that's involved. You also risk the potential that this sends flags your company if you're making this phone call. So it's really a strategically tough choice. I mean, you really want to do, again, some investigation. You want to do some legal research on the penal statutes, on the obstruction of justice issue, just to see what the law is out there on this corrupt intent and how that would be viewed. And again, I think you have to think about this desire that you don't want to have these documents destroyed if, in fact, there might be something exculpatory in nature within the document. That's all I was going to say. Okay. Rather than to get into this last page because it's going to take more than 5 minutes. I think I'm going to stop there. The only so we'll pick up with just probably 15 minutes of just running through two slides of this this trilemma dilemma, which is basically not only reviewing what we talked about with respect to 1.6 and 3.3, but also the 4.1 and the implications that that has. Next week, if you notice on the syllabus, I say attend the Lichtenstein lecture. Obviously, if you have a class conflict and you can't go to it, you can't go to it, and such is life. For those of you who don't, I would love to see you there. It's going to be a great lecture. It's ethics-oriented, and they'll be starting, I think, announcing that from about it on the calendar. If not, it should be going out for the next day or two. But it's next Wednesday. We just sit from 11 to 12, probably in room 308. And she's going to be talking about pro bono, publico, and a parallel universe, the meaning of pro bono and solo and small law firm. And Leslie Levin from the University of Connecticut School of Law is the student. Yeah, 11:10, 308. Okay, and then I'll see you in class at 2:10 next week. We'll pick up just a little bit of this, but we're done with the problems, and then we'll get into the new material on conflict. Yeah. Okay.
I'm going to get out of here. Yeah, I'm going to get out of here. 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 I'm